Is this yours? So I gave a message earlier. So it seems the message has not been communicated. So first we'll say the verses of taking refuge, and before the tea we'll say the verses of taking refuge and bodhicitta. And then while you take tea and bread, I will start with the discourse. So during now, while you are taking tea now, I take this opportunity to say something. So there are many foreigners, the Chinese, Koreans, Vietnamese, Japanese, these countries, which are, and also Mongolians, and people from Buryat, Kalmykia, Tuva, from the Russian Federation. So these places, people from these places are traditionally Buddhist. So we're all same followers of the Perfection of Wisdom's teachings and reciting the Heart Sutra. And then the Himalayan regions, people from them, where Buddhism spread from Tibet. And then there are many, hundreds of students in the monastic institutions here in South India who are studying Buddhist philosophy. And then there may be people from Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, Cambodia, Laos. Perhaps there may be people from these countries. So we are all the same followers of the same teacher. So except for some minor differences in according to the different lineages, there may be minor differences in the Vinaya practice. And then there are people from the European countries, and then there are a few Indians here. So actually, the Buddhism first spread in India, and then it flourished in Takshashila, and then Vikramalashila in Nalanda. So for thousands of years, advanced. And so these great Indian masters who are scholars and adepts were from this country. For example, the Drupchen, the Mahasiddha Saraha, and so forth. But in the meantime, Buddhism declined in India. And then in the recent centuries, the Sri Lankan Nagarika Dhammapala came to India and founded the Mahabodhi Societies. And then Dr. Ambedkar in the 50s took interest in Buddhism. And then there are people, Indians, who followed him and followed Buddhism. So Buddhism, in a way, is your ancestral religious tradition. And then there are people who were not traditionally Buddhist, but because Buddhism was from India, it's like your own ancestral heritage. And then, because of the swift communication, thanks to science and technological advancements in today's world, people have been taking interest in Buddhism, and then many books are also published. And then, because of these facilities, in Western countries, from the people from the Western countries, also who were not traditionally Buddhist countries, which were not for traditionally Buddhist countries. So people from the West also take interest in Buddhism, and many have actually come here to attend the teachings. And I always say that there are many religious traditions which have philosophical background to them. Of course, there are other religions, minor religions, for spirit worship and so forth, without philosophical background. But those with philosophical background, of course, have many followers. And so Christians, there are Christians, and then Muslims, and then Hindus. Millions of followers of these traditions are there. And so these different religious traditions with philosophical background have huge numbers of followers. Of course, they differ philosophically. For example, the theistic and non-theistic religious traditions. And then within those non-theistic ones, there are differences as to whether they accept an Atma or not. And then within the theistic religious traditions, there are differences as well, like that in Christianity they talk about the Trinity, and then in Islam they talk about only one Allah, God. But despite these philosophical differences, all these religious traditions acknowledge that compassion and love and compassion is something that we have innately, and this is something beneficial to us, and therefore to cultivate compassion, these philosophical traditions are there. And so religious tradition, theistic religious traditions, of course, for example, Islam sees, the Muslims see Allah as infinite love, and then they put their trust in Allah, and therefore what that makes them to do is to actually practice compassion. And so all these philosophical differences are meant for actually advancing this innate quality that we have, love and compassion. And also, these various religious traditions help. Whereas we usually have this very strong self-centered attitude, which is the cause of our suffering. And therefore, these religious traditions recognize that. And therefore, in the theistic religions, the followers actually submit themselves completely to their God. And through which, actually, because of giving themselves in to their God, they actually are able to reduce this self-centered, extreme self-centered attitude. And so whatever happens to me, these followers think that it is up to in the hands of God knows. And so these philosophical traditions, the different philosophical views of the religious traditions are meant for advancing this compassion. So for the last 2,000-3,000 years, these religious traditions have been there, whether we like it or not. So while we live together, we should not discriminate between these religious traditions. We should not be sectarian and have this kind of... because these religious traditions have helped their followers, and they are helping and they will help, and therefore it is very important for us to respect all the religious traditions. Otherwise, because of greed for power and wealth, there may be differences amongst peoples, but because of that, our religious traditions should not actually cause us to practice bigotry. We have to consider all the religious traditions and respect them all. And so I wish to say this while you take tea, and please keep this in mind. So my commitment is, I have this commitment of promoting human values, and therefore I tell let's talk about this. And as a Buddhist monk, and then I also work, and I'm committed to promote harmony among religions, traditions. And so if this could be accomplished, of course, it actually helps everyone. And therefore, all this is my commitment. It is my commitment to promote religious harmony. And all my brothers and sisters, keep this in mind. Foundation of good qualities, the kind and venerable spiritual masters are the foundation of all good qualities. Seeing that dependence on them is the root of the path, may I rely on them with great respect and continuous effort. Inspire me, thus, a human life with leisure is obtained this once, understanding that it has great value and is hard to find. May I produce unceasing the mind that takes hold of its essence day and night. Inspire me, thus, the fluctuation of our body and life is like a bubble of water. Remember death, for we perish quickly. After death, the effects of black and white karma pursue us as a shadow follows a body. Finding certainty in this, may I always be careful to abandon even the slightest negative action and to complete the accumulation of virtue. Inspire me thus. There is no satisfaction in enjoying worldly pleasures. They are the door to all misery. Having realized that the fault of samsaric perfections is that they cannot be trusted, may I strongly intent on the bliss of liberation. Inspire me thus. That pure thought to obtain liberation produces great conscientiousness, mindfulness, and awareness. May I make the essential practice keeping the vows of individual liberation the root of the doctrine. Inspire me thus. Having seen that all beings, my kind mothers, have fallen like myself into the ocean of cyclic existence, may I train in the supreme heart dedicated to enlightenment, assuming the obligation to free all migrating beings. Inspire me thus, generating the dedicated heart alone, without cultivation of the three moral practices, does not lead to enlightenment. Having realized this, may I practice with intense effort the vows of the conquerors and their spiritual children. Inspire me thus. By quieting distraction to false objects and analyzing the meaning of reality, may I quickly generate within my mind stream the path, uniting, combining insight. Inspire me thus. When trained in the common path, I'm a suitable vessel. Let me enter with ease and great ease the great gateway of the fortunate ones, the Vajrayana, the highest of all vehicles. Inspire me thus. The basis of achieving the two powerful attainments is the pure vows and commitments that I have pledged. Having found true understanding of this, may I keep them even at the cost of my life. Inspire me thus. Having realized the significance of the two stages, which are the essence of the tantric path, may I steadfastly practice without laziness the four sessions of yoga and realize what the holy beings have taught. Inspire me thus. May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I quickly and completely pacify all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray, in all my rebirths. May I never be separated from the perfect spiritual masters and enjoy the magnificent Dharma, completing all qualities of the stages and paths. May I quickly achieve the stage of Vajradhara. Mandala offering for requesting the teaching from His Holiness. This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, Mount Meru, four continents, and adorned with Mount Meru, four continents and sun and moon, I imagine as a Buddha field, a Buddha land, and offer it to you. May all beings enjoy this pure land. Yeah. I take refuge in the Buddha. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly by the virtuous merit I created. By listening to the Dharma, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit my creators. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. By the virtuous merit created by listening to the Dharma, may I attain Buddhahood to benefit all my creators. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. May the virtuous merit created by listening to the Dharma, may I attain Buddhahood to benefit all my creators. So this is calling on all the gods and non-humans to come to listen to the teaching of the Buddha. And they're asked to subdue their senses, the horrors of the unruly horrors of their senses, and listen very attentively to the teaching. It is worthy to listen, worthy of listening to. So I'll give this teaching in the languages of the humans, gods, asuras, and so forth, in the language of all different types of. I pay homage to the Gotama, who out of his compassion gave the holy teaching to rid us of all wrong views. So this verse that I just recited, the passages that I recited, so you have to actually, the teaching of the Buddha is like the nectar to the sentient beings, because it helps, it teaches the means to overcome our negative emotions, which actually disturb our mind, peace of mind. So from one's own experience, but many of us usually don't think about, we don't actually look inside or into ourselves, but try to actually check and examine others more. So if we look at the thousands of years of history of the world, we have all these battles and wars and problems because of our negative emotions, attachment and greed and hatred and so forth. And today also there is all these problems between nations, between communities, between families. So this, all the problems are rooted in our undisciplined mind. So seeing this, then making a prayer to God for blessings, of course helps, but in Buddhism and also in Hinduism and other non-Buddhist classical Indian traditions, the negative emotions of the desire realm are seen to be really disturbing our peace of mind, and therefore they teach the methods to overcome these. And especially in Buddhism, the explanation of negative emotions, destructive emotions, and making distinction between the gross and the subtle is taught very extensively. And so perhaps Buddhism has the most detailed explanation of negative emotions amongst all the religious traditions in the world. And so all troubles come from undisciplined mind. So of course the mind, the basic mind itself is not disturbed as such, not unruly or undisciplined, but there are certain agents which actually make the mind undisciplined. So we can make distinction between the sensory perceptions, the sensory consciousnesses, and mental consciousness. And then also we can also categorize mental factors into different categories. And all these detailed teachings on the mind and mental factors is there in Buddhism, which actually doesn't believe that our goals like higher rebirth or liberation and omniscience is not seen as something coming from, like a gift coming from God. So according to Buddhism, nobody is a Buddha right from the beginning. But Buddha himself, look at the life of the Buddha himself, he was an ordinary person like us from in the beginning. And then he actually went through the path and became enlightened. And then from his own experience, he was able to give the teaching according to the level of the disciples, from the beginner level and then progressing along the path and then reaching the higher advanced paths. So we have to know the map of the mind at this ordinary level that we are at, and see the problems, the sources of the problems that we face, and then know how to actually tackle these problems and transform our minds. So there are many types of afflictions, negative emotions. There are certain negative emotions which are called non-views, and then there are others which are called views. And so the non-views category of afflictions actually are rooted in the views. So now when you tackle these negative emotions, for example, ignorance cannot be directly overcome by practice of cultivation of love and compassion. And so to, uprooting it is not done by love and compassion. So, because of our intelligence, using reason and so forth, then we develop certain views. And these distorted views cannot be overcome merely by making prayers, but we have to show, we have to actually familiarize with the antidote to them. So the more, the greater the strength the antidote gains, more powerful it becomes to overcome, and finally diminish and overcome the negative emotions. So distorted views should be overcome by developing the view that sees the reality as it is. The correct view must be developed. So in the Heart Sutra mantra, there is this mention of the Gate Gate Baragate Parasamgate mantra, which refers to the gradual transformation of our mind by using our wisdom and intelligence and to strengthen it further and further. And developing this, the intelligence or the wisdom, realizing truth as it is, the emptiness. So whether your aim is to reach liberation or omniscient state of Buddhahood, so the purpose of cultivating wisdom, you have the purpose of cultivating this wisdom of realizing emptiness. And then when you actually develop the genuine wish to reach your goal, the liberation or omniscience, then you have reached the path represented by or referred by the first gate. And then when you develop the path which actually is the experience of the realization of emptiness experientially, you reach the path of preparation, which is referred by the second gate. And then when you actually realize emptiness directly, that is the path of seeing, which is the path of the noble being, referred by the paragate. And then you reach, after that, when you further develop your path, you reach the path of meditation, referred by parasamgate. And then, finally, you reach Buddhahood or enlightenment, referred by bodhisvaha. And so in the case of the bodhisattvas or Mahayana practitioners, you reach enlightened Buddhahood. And for those of the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas, their goal of enlightenment is their arhatship. So I usually also explain this mantra, Gate Gate mantra, in connection with our life, the transition in our life. So we have childhood, then youth, and then middle age, then old age, and so gate refers to our childhood and youth, and then paragate refers to our middle age, and then parasamgate refers to old age, and then finally is bodhisvaha, referring to our end of our life, the death. So Pabongka Rinpoche says, at the end of our life, even our breath, we have difficulty breathing, and then we stop breathing, and that's the end of our life. So I usually joke, jokingly explain or comment so when we pass through in the West some graveyards, I usually say this is where we are going to go, and bodhisvaha we will reach. So we, sentient beings who are full of negativities, negative emotions, and all this bondage within ourselves, but we can gradually eliminate these defilements that are within us, and then reach the final goal, ultimate goal of enlightenment, Buddhahood. So we have to actually think about using the mind to reach that goal. So if you really know the Dharma well, then of course reciting the verses of taking refuge and also reciting Mani Mantra hundreds of thousands of times will actually make sense. Otherwise, without having a good understanding of the entire teaching of the Buddha, the structure of the Buddhism, of course, then we will not make much advancements even by reciting mantras 100,000 times and so forth. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the Holiness. There's some problem with the so those who are engaged in studying the Dharma extensively over many years should actually know. The entire structure of the Buddhism through their studies of Prajaparamitas and Madhyamaka. And when it comes to actually putting these teachings into practice, then, of course, you can refer to the Lamrim Chemo. So in order to be able to do that, actually, you should have the understanding gained through the study of Prajaparamita and Madhyamaka studies. And being familiar with all the structure of Buddhism, then you can actually depend on Lamrim Chemo, bringing all these teachings into the Lamrim Chemo practice. And otherwise, when you practice Lamrim Chemo without really knowing what is taught in the Prajaparamita and Madhyamaka studies, it will not be so effective. And therefore, having studied extensively, if you could actually integrate these teachings within yourself to transform the mind, then that actually serves the purpose of your study well. Say, as we say, bringing down the studies into the practice. And so you do study very, you really work hard, and especially the teachers, you are actually becoming very old, but you still very put great effort and work hard to teach your students. And I would like to thank you all. And I usually, everywhere I go, I usually say that Tibetan Buddhism is a pure Nalanda tradition. Very proudly, I say this. So these classic texts written by the Nalanda masters, these in monastic institutions we have in the Tibetan communities are the ones who actually preserve these classic texts through study and practice. So without students, without there being people who study these classic texts, it would be, have been very difficult to preserve and promote the tradition of Nalanda. And we have these monastic traditions in the Gelug tradition, the three seats of learning, Sairardepungadhan and also Tashilambo. And also, there are people from the Trans-Himalayan regions all who take interest, who have been taking interest in studying Buddhism. And then within Tibet, the situation is very difficult for the people there, Tibetans, but there are, in remote places, there are few people who actually put so much effort, work hard to set up study centers of Buddhism to study the classic texts. So there are people who do that, which is very good. And I would like to thank everyone for your determination and dedication to the study of classic texts. Regarding Venerable our Garden Rinpoche, a great personality. So now we have set up a seat for the Garden Tepa to an institution, so that Garden Rinpoche could give advice and guidance, and which could be carried on by the abbots and former abbots of these monastic institutions, and also particularly the teachers in these monastic institutions. So I wish to say that, of course, you have been working hard to keep up with the study and education, and I would like to urge you to continue to do so. So as to how to lead a disciple onto the path, there is so we have come to the point of reflecting on the future life, contemplating what will occur in your future life, the happiness of or suffering of the two types of beings. On page 161, chapter 10, the first paragraph. So we are all under the force of our karma. Therefore, if we are born into the lower realms, you should think, how would it be if I were born into miserable realm? And then there is the quotation from Master Nagarjuna. So human body, it says in the human body, so reflect daily on the hell, both those extremely hot and cold, reflect also the hungry ghosts. So here in this text it says, observe and reflect on the animals overcome by the suffering and stupidity. Of course, the realms of hell, hell realm, and pratha realms are something not which are which are something which not acceptable to us now. But animal realm is something we see. So we human beings are said to have attained higher rebirth, higher status, but we have all kinds of problems, misfortunes. But we can see sufferings in continuous suffering in the animals. So there is not much thinking going on in the using intelligence in the animals. And perhaps because of that, they may have lesser problems and suffering based on using the mind, based on the mind. And as the 400 verses of Aryadeva says, the people who are well off or higher in status and so forth have more mental problems, whereas the lower ones, people who are poor, have more physical problems. And so that those who are higher or more knowledgeable and so forth look down upon others and even disregard others, are inconsiderate. And so accordingly they have problems. And so eliminate the causes of these and create the causes of happiness. A human body in this world is difficult to obtain. Once you have it, diligently stop the causes of miserable rebirths. So next paragraph, on 162. So it is extremely important to meditate in general on the sufferings of cyclic existence, and in particular on the sufferings of miserable realms. For if you contemplate how you have fallen into the ocean of suffering, you'll then turn away from it and thereby overcome your pride and arrogance. Seeing suffering as a result of non-virtuous karma, you will be... So this verse from the engaging in the Bodhisattva deeds of Chandideva is taught at the point of the where he teaches to accepting the patience of accepting suffering. So although engaging the Bodhisattva discusses these qualities of suffering from the viewpoint of suffering experienced in the past, the same qualities characterize future suffering as well. Next, an outline, contemplating the suffering of hell denizens, and within which there's a contemplation of the suffering of the great hells of living beings. There are eight great hells. The reviving hell, the first, lies 32,000 leagues beneath us. The other seven are situated every 4,000 leagues beneath that. The living beings of the reviving hell assemble and hack each other with various weapons that appear one by one through the force of karma until they swoon and fall to the ground. Then a voice from the sky commands, revive, and they rise up again, hack each other as before, and experience measureless suffering. In the black line hell, the hell guardians use black lines to mark the bodies of living beings born there into quarters, eights, and many other smaller divisions. The beings experience the pain of being split and chopped along these lines. with weapons. When the living beings in the crushing hell gather and congregate, the hell guardians herd them all between two iron mountains shaped like goat heads and then squeeze them between the mountains, causing streams of blood to gush from their all their orifices. They are also pressed between sheep-headed, horse-headed, elephant-headed, lion-headed, and tiger-headed mountains. When they gather together again, they are inserted into a great iron machine and pressed like sugar cane. Then they reassemble on an iron surface where great iron boulders are hurled upon them, cutting, splitting, smashing, and flattening them again, causing torrents of blood to gush forth. And then next is a howling hell, and then the great howling hell, and hot hell. In the hot hell, the hell guardians throw the living beings into a hot, blazing iron kettle many leagues across and boil them, deep frying them like fish. Then they impale them through the anuses with blazing iron skewers which emerge through the crowns of their heads. Blazing flames leap forth from their mouths, eyes, ears, nose, and from all their pores. Then they are placed either on their back or face down on the blazing iron surface, where they are pounded flat with a hot blazing iron hammer. In the extremely hot hell, the guardians force iron tridents into their victims' anuses, the left and right prongs coming out at their shoulders and the center prong at the crown of their heads, causing blazing flames to shoot out from their mouths and other orifices. Their bodies are caught in hot, blazing iron press. They are thrown head first into a great blazing iron kettle full of boiling water and boiled, floating up, down, and all around, until their skin, flesh, blood are destroyed and only their skeleton remain. Thereupon the guardians fish them out, spread them on the iron surface where their skin, flesh, and blood regenerate, and then throw them back into the kettle. The remaining torments are similar to those of the hot hell. In the unrelenting hell, the ground blazes from many hundreds of leagues from the east. As this blaze increases, it assumes the force of conflagration, and then it then gradually incinerates the skin, flesh, intestine, and bones of the living beings, penetrating all the way to their marrow. The beings' entire bodies are engulfed in blazing flames as if they were the wicks of butter lamps. The same thing occurs from the other three directions. When the fires arriving from all four directions, they combine, and beings experience uninterrupted suffering. You know them to be living beings only by the piteous wails they emit. On other occasions, they are placed into blazing iron embers in an iron winnowing basket, and the basket is shaken violently. On other occasions, they are forced to climb up great iron mountains, then fall from them onto an iron surface. On other occasions, their tongues are pulled out of their mouth and stretched out with 100 iron picks, like ox hides, until they have no wrinkles or ridges. At other times, they are laid out on their backs on the iron surface, and their mouths are pried open with iron tongs, while blazing lumps of iron and boiling copper are forced in until their mouths, esophagi, and intestines are burnt and the residue flows out below. The other torments are like those of the extremely hot hell. This is only a rough description of the torments, but there are many others as well. I have written about the locations and suffering of these hells exactly as they are explained in the levels of the yogic deeds. The duration of this suffering is explained in the friendly letter. Even though You experience such horrible sufferings for a billion years, you do not die until the non-virtue is spent. So next is contemplating the suffering of the adjoining hells. So each of the eight hot hells has four walls and out four doors and is encircled by an iron fence which has four doors. At each of these doors there are four additional hells for living beings: the pit of bambers, the swamp of putrid corpses or the swamp of excrements that stings like a corpse, the path of razors and such, and the river with no ford. The first of these contains embers in which the denizens sink up to their knee. When these beings go there in search of a home, they step into it, and their skin, flesh, and blood are completely destroyed, only to regenerate when they lift their feet out again. Not far away lies the second hell, a swamp of excrement stinking like a corpse, into which living beings seeking a home attempt to cross but fall, sinking in over their shoulders. The swamp is inhabited by sharp-beaked worms which pierce the skin, flesh, intestine, and bones, boring down the marrow. Nearby is the third hell, where living beings who seek a home walk a path filled with razor teeth. With each step, the teeth lacerate their skin, flesh, and blood. But each time they lift their feet, their bodies regenerate. Nearby is the sword-leaved forest. When living beings who seek a home sit down to rest there in the shade, swords drop down from the trees, piercing and splitting their limbs, fingers, and toes. When they swoon, they are attacked by mongrel dogs who carry them off by the scruffs of their necks and eat them. Nearby is the forest of iron silk cotton trees. Living beings who seek a home come and climb these trees, which are covered with thorns that point downwards on this way, up and up, on the way up and upwards on the way down, so that the thorns pierce and split the being's limbs. Fine fingers and toes, iron-beaked crows, sit on their shoulders or heads and pluck out and eat their eyeballs. Since all of these places subject to inhabitants to harm, subject the inhabitants to harm by means of weapons, they should be counted as one adjoining hell. The fourth hell is nearby the silk cotton trees. The river with no ford is full of boiling water. Living beings who seek a home fall into it and are tossed about and cooked as though they were peas thrown into a pot of water over a great blazing water fire. On both banks of this river sits beings armed with clubs, hooks, and nets, who keep the tormented from escaping, or who drag them out with the hooks and nets and lay them on their backs on the great blazing ground, demanding to know what they want. When they reply, "We do not understand at all and cannot see, but we are hungry and thirsty," they are fed blazing lumps of iron and boiling copper. I have presented these hells in accordance with the levels of yogic deeds as well. It states that the lifespans of living beings in their adjoining health and occasional health are not fixed, but they must suffer in these places for a long time until the power of the karma for experiencing these sufferings is exhausted. Next, contemplating the sufferings of cold hells. So next, contemplating the suffering of the occasional hells. So according to the basis of discipline, they also exist near the shores of lakes. So His Holiness was emphasizing here, they also exist near the shores of great lakes. as depicted in the edifying tale of Sangharakshita. So, contemplating the suffering of the occasional healths adjoin the hot healths and cold healths, and the levels of yogic deeds says that they exist in the human regions as well. So the auto commentary of Vasubandhu's Abhidhamma Kosha says the 16 healths living beings are created by the force of karma of all living beings. The occasional healths are created by the individual karma of one, two, or many living beings, and therefore are of many different types. They have no fixed location since they exist in rivers, mountains, wastelands, below the earth, and in other places as well. Thus, as explained before, below, the conditions for being born in any of these hells are very easy to create, and every single day you acquire more of them. Since you have already accumulated innumerable causes in the past, your complacence is inappropriate. Therefore, after reflecting on these hells, be frightened. Nothing separates you from them after the mere cessation of your breath. Engaging in the bodhisattva deeds says, having created the karma for hell, why are you complacent like this? And the friendly letter says, sinners who hear the boundless suffering in the hells, separated from them only until the mere termination of their breathing, and are not completely terrified, have hearts as hard as diamonds. If you are frightened merely by seeing paintings of hell, by hearing of it, recalling it, reading about it, and by representations of it, what need to mention experiencing the fears actually of it, experiencing the fears actuality of it. Among the sufferings of cycling existence, those of the miserable realms are the most difficult to endure. Among these, the sufferings of hells are the most unbearable, for the pain of being continually pierced by 300 sharp spears for a full day is nothing compared to even the mildest of the hell's sufferings. Among the hells, the sufferings of unrelenting hell is by far the greatest. The friendly letter says, just as among all kinds of happiness, the cessation of craving is the king of happinesses, so among all kinds of suffering, the suffering of the unrelenting hell is most fierce. The suffering of being viciously pierced with the 300 lances for a full day cannot compare, cannot even be mentioned with the least sufferings of hell. Know that the sole cause of such sufferings is your physical, verbal, and mental wrongdoing. Strive with whatever human skills you have not to be defiled by even the slightest wrongdoing. The same text says, friendly letters is, the seeds of these non-virtuous results is your physical, verbal, and mental wrongdoing. Strive with whatever skill you possess not to have even a bit of it. Next is contemplating the suffering of animals. Powerful animals kill weaker ones. Deities and humans exploit animals. Since others control them, animals have no independence and are harmed, bitten, and killed. The level of yogic deeds explains that since they dwell with deities and men, they have no other abode. The Treasury of Knowledge auto commentary says, animals range over the land, in the water, and in the sky. Their primary abode is the great ocean. The others have spread from there. Also, the friendly letter says, in rebirth as an animal, there are various sufferings and so forth. And next, contemplating the suffering of hungry ghosts. So regarding the animal realm, as far as their lifespans are concerned, the Treasury of Knowledge says the longest an eon. He explains that the most long-lived animals endure for about an eon, and that the lifespans of short-lived animals are not fixed. and contemplating suffering of hungry ghosts, those who are exceedingly miserly are born as hungry ghosts. These beings are hungry and thirsty, and their skin, flesh, and blood are desiccated, giving them the appearance of burned locks. Their faces are covered with hair, their mouths are extremely dry, and their tongues lick their lips constantly. There are three types of hungry ghosts. Hungry ghosts who have external obstacles for obtaining food and drink. Hungry ghosts who have internal obstacles for obtaining food and drink. And hungry ghosts who have obstacles within the food and drink. So when these hungry ghosts, the approach brings lakes and ponds, beings hold swords, long spears, spears and short spears, block. Beings holding swords, long spears and short spears block their way, or else the water appears to them as pus and blood, and they lose the desire to drink. So this is with the first type of hungry ghost. And the second type, these beings have goiters and great bellies, but their mouth, which spew flames, are as small as the eye of a needle. Though others do not prevent them, they are unable to ingest food or drink, even when they obtain. And the hungry ghosts who have obstacles within the food and drink, some of these hungry ghosts, unable to make use of clean and wholesome food and drink, cut their own flesh and eat. Those called possessing a garland of flames are burnt because wherever they attempt to eat or drink bursts into flames. Those called filth eaters can only ingest dirty, stinking, harmful, and despicable things, and so they eat feces and drink urine. With respect to their bodies, the Treasury of Knowledge auto-commentary says the king of the hungry ghosts is called Yama. Their primary abode is 500 leagues beneath the city of Rajgriha in Jambudvipa, this world. The others have spread from there. And then there are quotations from the Vedas, friendly letter. The first verse teaches the general sufferings of the hungry ghost, and the remaining verses teach the specific sufferings. Exhaustion refers to fatigue from running after food. Fear refers to terror of seeing beings holding swords, clubs, and nooses. Garbage refers to unwanted trash. At night indicates the flames come out of their mouths nightly. Cause their mouths to blaze indicates that the food they eat causes their mouths to blaze. Some hungry ghosts' gazes will dry up even a sweet, cool stream, as though their eyes burned with strong poison. The clear word explanation of friendly letters explains that that for some hungry ghosts, a stream appears as if it were filled with a mass of blazing embers. For others, it seems to be a flowing stream of pus filled with various insects. Also contemplate what Chandragami's letter to a student says. Tormented by a terrible thirst, they see a pure stream from afar and desire to drink it. When they arrive, it changes into a river filled with a mixture of oyster shells, strands of hair, putrid pus, a cesspool of blood and excrement. If they go to the top of the cool hill with moist spring breezes and a grove of verdant sandalwood trees, it becomes for them a forest fire enveloped in leaping flames and heaped with falling, burning logs. When they go to a seashore covered with clear, glittering foam from crashing waves, it becomes for them a wasteland, blasted by hot sand, dark mist, and searing wind. Dwelling in that place, they long for rain clouds to appear. Whereupon there issues from the clouds a rain of iron arrows, smoking cinders, and sparkling diamond heart boulders, and one after the other, golden orange lightning bolts fall on their bodies like rain. For those afflicted by heat, even a snowstorm is hot. For those tormented by wind, even fire is cold. This entire universe appears upside down to these hungry ghosts, confused by the fruition of terrible karma. Even if one afflicted with a mouth the size of a mere needle's eye and a stomach of many lakes drinks the water of the great ocean. The water cannot pass through the opening of its throat, and its poisonous mouth evaporates every drop. So with regard to their lifespan, the levels of yogic deeds and treasury of knowledge, the hungry goats endure for 500 hungry ghost years, with each of their days being equivalent to a human month. The friendly letter says, some living beings enduring continuous suffering, bound tightly by the ropes of the karma of wrongdoing, do not die for 5,000 or even 10,000 years. The clear word explanation of the friendly letter explains that some hungry ghosts live 5,000 and others 10,000 years. The levels of yogic deeds says that the size of their bodies is not fixed in any of the three miserable realms. It varies in accordance with their non-virtuous karma. Thus, when you contemplate these sufferings of the miserable realms, think like this. At present, it is difficult to endure sitting for merely a single day with my hand stuck in burning coals, or to remain naked for that long in a cave of ice during the winter winds, or to go for a few days without food and drink, or for my body to be stung by a bee and the like. Even when these are difficult to endure, how will I bear the sufferings of the hot hells, the cold hells, the hungry ghosts, or the animals devouring each other? After you have assessed your current condition, meditate until your mind is filled with fear and dread. Simply knowing about this without conditioning your mind to it, or only meditating on it for a little while, will not accomplish anything. Then there's a quotation from the basis of discipline. And thus, meditation on suffering puts an end to laziness and generates joyous perseverance at accomplishing the path. It spurs you toward liberation and is the root of the cause for attaining it. Since it was praised for this even when it was praised for this even when the teacher was alive, he had nothing superior to teach us as personal instruction for liberation. This passage shows clearly the progression of the contemplation for the persons of small and medium scopes. As for the measure of the attitudes of these two types of persons, you must constantly strive to meditate on these points until you develop an attitude like that of Ananda's nephews. So as long as we are under the power, we are overpowered by the karma and delusions, we will have samsaric body and mind, which give rise to suffering of change, and conditioned suffering. So all of us, including animals, do not want the painful, obvious painful suffering of suffering. Whether the places and abodes that are mentioned in this are literal or not, can be literally accepted or not, but there is the possibility of attaining cessation and nirvana. Although we are so much habituated with this self-cherishing attitude since time beginningless, we can still see that how we can actually make transformation within ourselves if we actually put into practice the teachings. We can see this gradual transformation and to take us lead ourselves closer to the goal of liberation. And so when we create the positive causes and conditions, we will see, we can see the effects, the positive consequences of them as well. And while we are in the samsara, we can attain higher rebirths and then use that life to progress along the paths and the grounds by disciplining our mind. So this human life is like the watershed, whether you go up towards the higher realms and nirvana and so forth, or you lead yourself down. This is because whether you lead yourself upwards or downwards is dependent on your mind. When you have undisciplined mind, when your mind is unruly, you create all sorts of causes for to lead yourself down. And when you have all the use this mind to create positive causes, you will lead yourselves upwards. And so these are possible for us. So because of our undisciplined mind, we harm others, and therefore, consequently, we have suffering, incessant suffering, which we can actually see in this very life also. So if we have created a negative karma which will lead us to lower realms of existence, and this karma remains in our minds without being overcome or eliminated, then this will give rise to the effect, the consequence. So we talk about liberation and omniscience, but in our actual practice, what we do is we create the karmas for lower realms of existence. And so what this does is lead us to the lower realms of existence. So we stop here for in Lam Chemo, the completed the thinking about the suffering of lower realms. We moved on to the middle length Lamrim, the suffering of lower realms. This has three parts. You should think about the suffering of the lower realms, considering what will become of me if I'm born reborn in the lower realms. And then the Nagarjuna's friendly letters is, every day remember the hells, which are fiercely hot and cold. Also remember the hungry ghosts emaciated by hunger. So look at the animals and remember, they are beset with sufferings of dullness. Give up their causes, create causes of happiness. Once you have gained what is hard to gain, a human body in Jambudvipa, this earth, endeavor to cut the course of bad rebirths. So meditation on the suffering of cyclic existence in general and the lower realms in particular is a very vital point. For if you thus consider how you yourself fall into the ocean of suffering, despair will repel pride and arrogance. Having seen that suffering is a result of non-virtue, you'll be very careful to avoid negativities and downfalls. Since you do not want suffering but want happiness, once you realize that it's the result of virtue, you will also enjoy accomplishing virtue. In proportion to your own experience, compassion for others will arise, and out of aversion to cyclic existence, you will strive for liberation. For fear of suffering, you will take refuge forcefully. These positive qualities of suffering that comprise many important points of practice are stated in the engaging in the Bodhisattva conduct. In terms of suffering already arisen in one's own continuum, however, they are equally applicable to suffering one is yet to experience. And then contemplating the suffering of hell beings and contemplating the suffering of the animals, hungry ghosts, and contemplating suffering of animals. The great hell of sentient beings. 32,000 yojanas below here, there is a continual revival, and below are the seven more hells, each separated by 4,000 yojanas. In the first of those eight continual revival, the sentient beings come together and stab each other with various weapons that arise by the power of their karma. Whenever they faint and collapse on the ground, a voice rings out from the sky commanding, "Come back to life." Upon that, they stand up again and start stabbing as before, experiencing immeasurable suffering as a result. In black line, the hell guardians put black lines in the shape of numerous squares and the like on the bodies of the sentient beings born there, and then the latter experience pain of being cut into pieces with weapons along those lines. In crushing hell, once the ground guardians have rounded up the sentient beings, they pack them together to between two goat faces or similar iron mountains. Then they are immediately crushed by the two, whereupon rivers of blood spurt out from all their orifices. In howling hell, the sentient beings in search of an abode enter an iron house. As soon as they enter, fires blaze up all around them and they burn. Great howling hell is like the previous one, the difference being that the iron house has two layers. In the hot hell, the hell guardians put the sentient beings into very hot and blazing iron cauldrons of several yojanas and fry them like fish. They are impaled through their buttocks on blazing iron stakes that emerge through the crown of their heads. Fire blazes out of their mouths, their eye sockets, nostrils, and ears, as well as their pores. They are laid out on their backs or face down on the blazing iron foundation and pounded and tormented with blazing iron hammers. In very hot hell, an iron trident is stuck into their buttocks so that the right and left prongs emerge from their two shoulders and the middle one from the crown of their heads. Owing to that, tongues of fire blaze from their orifices such as the mouth. Their bodies are wrapped in blazing hot iron sheets and placed headlong into an iron cauldron full of boiling liquid, whereupon they are tossed up, down, and about as they boil. Once their skin, flesh, and blood have been destroyed, nothing but the skeleton is left. They are pulled out again and spread out on the iron foundation. After that, when the skin, flesh, and blood have developed again, they are put in again. Apart from that, it is like hot hell. In the hot hell without spite, a foundation is completely ablaze for hundreds of yojanas from the eastern direction. As it spreads, the force of the fire increases, gradually destroying the skin, flesh, sinews, and bones of the sentient beings to the marrow, like the wick of a butter lamp. Their whole bodies are pervaded by blazing tongues of fire. In the other three directions, it is similar. As the fire coming from the four directions mingles there, these beings experience incessant suffering, and only by their pathetic howling are they understood to be sentient beings. In an iron baskets, they are made to jump about on blazing metals. They are made to fall around on the iron foundation and to climb up huge iron mountains. Their tongues are pulled out from their mouths, then stretched out with 100 pecks and made to be without faults or creases, as though preparing cow hides. Then again, they are placed on the iron foundation on their backs. Their mouths are opened with iron tongs, and blazing lumps of iron are inserted into their mouths. Boiling copper is poured into their mouths and burns their mouths, throat, and entrails before issuing forth from their lower bodies. Apart from that, it is like very hot hell. How long those sufferings are experienced is as stated in friendly letters. Even if for billions of years you experience completely unbearable suffering in that way, as long as the non-virtue has not been exhausted, equally long you will not be rid of your life. Moreover, the treasury of manifest knowledge and actuality of the stages, and it is stated that 50 human years are one day in the God realm of the four great kings, 30 of those are 1 month, and 12 of those are 1 year. 500 such years is the lifespan of the beings of four great kings. All of this is one single day in continual revival. 30 of those is a month, 12 of those is a year, and 500 of those is the lifespan of... lifespan there. Likewise, 100, 200, 400, 800, 1600 human years respectively form a day in the other five desire realm gods, ranging from the 33 up to controlling others' emanations, and their lifespans can be 1,000, 2,000, 4,000, 8,000 and 16,000 god years. Years respectively form a day in black line through hot hell, and they can reach from 1,000 to 16,000 of their own years. In very hot hell, they can reach half an intermediate eon, and in without spite, one intermediate eon. And next is about neighboring hells. In the cold hell, the occasional hells. In contemplating the sufferings of animals, then the sufferings of hungry ghosts. Contemplating the suffering of animals. So the weaker animals are killed by more powerful ones, having become the chattels of chattels of gods and humans. They are under the control of others and lack freedom, which is why they are killed, beaten, and harmed. It is explained in the equality of stages. Or the yogic of the levels of yogic deeds, that since they accompany humans and gods, they do not have any another abode. The auto commentary of the Treasury of Knowledge explains that their main abode is the great ocean, and that the others spread out from there. Furthermore, they are born in darkness and in water, age there and die. They are worn out by heavy burdens, put to plow, shorn, driven and killed miserably by means of many different killing methods. They are tormented by hunger, thirst, sun and wind. They are persecuted by hunters and the like in many ways, and are always terrified. Therefore, you should feel saddened and disquieted thinking of the many ways in which they suffer. With respect to their lifespan, the longest animal span is one eon, and it is explained that the long-lived ones reach about an eon, while the short-lived ones are unspecified. Contemplating the suffering of hungry ghosts. So those who predominantly rely on miserliness will be born as hungry ghosts. They are too hungry and thirsty. Since their skin, flesh, and blood are dried up, they are like burnt log. Their faces are covered with hair, their mouths are exceedingly dry, and they lick them with their tongues. There are the three types, those with external obstructions to food and drink, those with internal obstructions to food and drink, and those with obstructions to food and drink itself. So if they wander, those with external obstructions to food and drink, if they wander towards springs, lakes, and ponds, they are hindered externally by insentient beings holding swords, spears, and lances. They also see the water as pus and blood and do not want to drink it. Those with internal obstructions to food and drink, they have mouths like the mere eye of a needle. Even if they end up with finding food and drink without others creating obstructions, they themselves are not able to eat and drink them. and those with obstructions to food and drink itself. So this section is finished, and next is explaining how to rely on the methods for the happiness of future. Namrimcham. Relying on the means for achieving happiness in the next life. The means for achieving happiness in the next life, I explained in two parts. Training in the good, going for refuge, the excellent door for entering the teaching and developing the faith of conviction. That is the root of all temporary happiness and certain goodness. The training in going for refuge, the excellent door for entering the teaching. Going for refuge is explained in four parts, the causes of going for refuge. Number one, number two, based on that, the objects to which you go for refuge. Number three, the way you go for refuge. And number four, once you have gone for refuge, the stages of the precepts. The causes for going for refuge, in general, there are many causes. However, regarding the quotation from Dignaga, it is the taking refuge with the wish to reach and reach liberation. So in brief, the causes for going for refuge are twofold. You fear the miserable realms and the like, and your conviction that the three jewels can protect you from them. Thus, you must strive to realize these two causes, because if they remain mere words, so will your refuge. But if they are strong and stable, your refuge will transform your mind. And next is, based on that, the objects of to which you go for refuge. Identifying the objects to which you go for refuge. So in praise of the Buddha, the author says, I do not consider the Buddha better than the others, and I'm not averse to other teachers of other traditions. But I consider the one who actually resorts to reason to be the better one. So when you study the different philosophical thoughts, the purpose of doing so is studying them is to actually see the uniqueness of one's own tradition and how to go about with taking refuge based on reason and logic, and so that you feel convinced about the uniqueness of your own objects of refuge. And here in Chandrakirti's 70 verses of refuge says, the Buddha teaching and the community are the refuge for those who desire liberation. And so this makes a difference here that it's not only doing some good practice, wholesome practice, which of course the other traditions also have, which will lead us to higher rebirths. So in our case, we do not want suffering, but we want happiness, but we are overpowered by our destructive emotions. As long as this is there, then we have suffering. But once this destructive emotions are completely overcome, then we reach nirvana or liberation. And so this the root of samsara is ignorance, the fundamental ignorance, and therefore of uprooting this through the experience and understanding of the reality, the truth, and you lead yourself out of samsara and reach nirvana. So other traditions do not are not able to explain, other teachers of other religious traditions are not able to explain this kind of nirvana that is explained in Buddhism. So if you really give thought to this, and how you actually lead yourself to nirvana, through reasoning you can establish it, and therefore Chandrakirti's verse says that the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha are the refuges for those who desire liberation. So the next, the reason why they are worthy to be a refuge. There are four reasons why the Buddha is worthy to be a refuge. First, he has mastered himself and attained the sublime state of fearlessness. If he had not attained this, he would not be able to protect others from all fears, just as a person who has already fallen down cannot help up someone else who has fallen down. Second, he is in all ways skilled in the means of training disciples. If he were not so, he would not be able to fulfill your needs, even if you went to him for refuge. Third, he has great compassion. If he did not have it, he would not protect you even if you went to him for refuge. Fourth, he is pleased, not by material offerings, but by offerings of practice. If he were not, he would not act as a refuge for everyone, but would help only those who had previously helped him. In brief, only one who is free of all fears, who is skilled in the means of freeing others from fears, who has great impartial compassion for everyone, and who acts for everyone's welfare, regardless of whether or not they have benefited him, is worthy of being a refuge. Since only the Buddha has these qualities and the divine creator and so on do not, he alone is the refuge. Therefore, his teaching and the community of his disciples are also worthy of being a refuge. Thus, after you have ascertained these things, which are taught in the compendium of determinations, entrust yourself to the three jewels with a single-pointed focus. And so this is regarding the praise in honor of the worthy one. So of course, all the religious followers of the different traditions like Christianity, Islam and so forth, of course, praise their own founder teachers, but you have to also see whether they actually are in accord with those praises and in accord with the reality or not. And therefore, in Buddhism, we talk about praising the Buddha by understanding his teaching. So I had a Christian friend, a very good practitioner. We were sitting together, and then there were a few of his disciples as well, and he actually chanted some praise of God. And while he did that, he actually shed tears. So I found that quite appreciated that, because of his faith and devotion to his God. But Christianity and other religious traditions, the teachers, the founders, have taught their disciples to actually believe in what they have taught them. And they are not actually saying what the Buddha himself has said. So keep... they teach their disciples to keep faith in them and believe in what they have said. But the Buddha has said his disciples and his followers must actually examine his own teachings. So in the modern times, we have the communist Chinese who actually try to impose things on others without really showing the reasons. And so, we have to understand the Four Noble Truths as to support our faith and belief in the teaching of the Buddha. As it will come later, we have to understand the two truths, and on the basis of which we have to understand the Four Noble Truths. And within the context of the Four Noble Truths, we can understand how there is incompatibility between what appears and what actually is. And when... So, because things are not what they appear, but we actually see, and actually what appears to us is that things have some kind of absolute or objective existence. Whereas it's not the case, and therefore, when you see that, then you will see how the conventional truth actually is, and how we create the suffering through the origin of suffering. As Tsongkhapa says, you will not be captivated by any by the views clinging to extremes. If you understand that emptiness and the appearances will not actually emptiness and appearances actually give rise to the understanding of. Where it says, furthermore, when appearances dispel the extremes of existence and when emptiness dispels the extremes of non-existence, and if you understand how emptiness arises, cause and effect, you will never be captivated by the views grasping at extremes. So with regard to Rama Tsongkhapa's Lam Rim Chemo, he mainly bases himself on the texts written by Master Asanga and his disciples, and then when Lama Tsongkhapa comes to the deal with the emptiness section, the insight section, then he mainly bases on Master Nagarjuna and his disciples. The way to go for refuge, there are four aspects to going for refuge: by knowing the qualities, good qualities, by knowing distinctions through commitment, and by refusing to acknowledge other refuges. So going for refuge by knowing the qualities, since going for refuge by knowing the good qualities requires recalling the good qualities of the refuge, there are three divisions, subdivisions to this topic: the good qualities of Buddha, the good qualities of teaching, and community. The good qualities of the Buddha, these are explained in four parts. The good qualities of the Buddha, this entails recollection of the Buddha's auspicious signs and exemplary features. Recall them as they are taught in the praise by example section of the praise in honor of one worthy of honor. Your body adorned with signs is beautiful, an elixir for the eye. It's like a cloudless autumn sky decorated with clusters of stars. O golden sage, beautifully draped and draped with religious robes, you are like a golden mountain peak wrapped in the clouds of the sunrise or sunset. O protector, even the full moon, free of clouds, cannot compare with the radiant orb of your face, free of the embellishment of jewelry. Should a bee see the lotus of your face and a lotus opened by the sun, it would wonder which was the real lotus. Your white teeth beautify your golden face like pure moonbeams in autumn pouring through the gaps between golden mountains. Oh, one who so worthy of worship, your right hand adorned with the sign of the wheel makes the gesture of relief to people terrified by cyclic existence. O sage, when you walk, your feet leave marks on this earth like splendid lotuses. How can it be beautified by lotus gardens? The good qualities of the Buddha's speech. Reflect, and then next is the good qualities of the mind of the Buddha's mind. These are explained in terms of good qualities of knowledge and the good qualities of caring. The good qualities of knowledge, without obstruction, The Buddha's knowledge contacts the real nature and diversity of all phenomena as if they were a dhatri fruit placed in the palm of your hand. Thus, the sage's knowledge comprehends all phenomena, whereas others' limited knowledge cannot comprehend the vast objects that are to be known. You should reflect on this knowledge as it is described in the praise in honor of the worthy praise. Only your sublime wisdom comprehends all objects of knowledge. For even everyone other than you, there are objects yet to be known. O Bhagwan, the entire origin of all the types of phenomena throughout time is within the range of your mind, like an umbalan fruit in the palm of your hand. Like the wind moving across the sky, your mind is unimpeded with respect to a single, to the single and manifold, the manifold animate and inanimate phenomena, the qualities of good qualities of caring. In the same way that living beings are bound inescapably by the afflictions, so is the sage bound by great compassion, which thus arises continuously as he beholds the sufferings of living beings. You should reflect on this as set forth in the praise in 150 verses. The afflictions bind all these beings without exception. You, in order to release them from their afflictions, are eternally bound by compassion. Should I first make it a business to you, or to the great compassion that causes you to dwell for so long in cycling existence, despite knowing its faults? Also, chapter of the Truth Speaker says, the Supreme Sage feels great compassion when he sees beings whose minds are constantly obscured by the dark gloom of ignorance, locked in the prison of cycling existence. And also, the conqueror feels great compassion when he sees beings whose minds are overwhelmed by attachment, who have great craving and always long for sensory objects, and who have fallen into the ocean of craving's attachment. The one possessing the ten powers feels compassion, which seeks to dispel all suffering when he sees the afflictions of beings harmed by a multitude of illnesses and miseries. The sage's compassion arises constantly. It is impossible for it not to do so. But the Buddha is free of all faults because he is concerned with the needs of all living beings. The good qualities of enlightened activities. The enlightened activities of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind, being both spontaneous and everlasting, help all living beings. If disciples are open to his guidance, the sage will give them that which is excellent and lead them out of trouble. Thus, the Buddha's activities are certain to do even everything that needs to be done. You should reflect on this as set forth in the praise in 150 verses. You explain the destruction of afflictions, reveal the deceitfulness of demons, proclaim the terrifying nature of cycling existence, and show the way of fearlessness. O compassionate one, wishing to help, you act for the sake of living beings. How could there be something helpful which you have not done? And the praise and honor of the worthy one of praise says, what trouble is there away from which you cannot lead living beings? What excellent thing is there that you cannot bestow on the world? So the preceding briefly summarizes the way to reflect on the Buddha. If you reflect in a variety of ways, your faith will also arise in many ways. The more you reflect, the stronger and more enduring your faith will become. The same applies to the good qualities of the other two jewels. When you have gained certainty by meditating in this way, you will understand that the scriptures and their commentaries are instructions in that most of them teach the good qualities of the three refuges. People who reject analytical meditation as a practice, thinking that it is mere conceptualization, shut off many such ways of accumulating merit and clearing away obscuration. Therefore, be aware that such a rejection is a great obstacle to taking advantage of the boundless potential of life of leisure and opportunity. The more you practice these things, the more accustomed your mind will become to them, and the easier it will be to practice that you had initially found difficult to learn. You will develop the spirit of enlightenment, thinking, I too should obtain Buddhahood like the Buddha whom I recollect. So, so we can also think along the lines of reasoning, which says, by finding the Buddha to be authoritative, then we can also try to find determine that his teachings are infallible. And proving that the teaching of the Buddha is the path or teaching which leads disciples to have the aspiration for liberation. And then perhaps there is different ways of actually leading disciples to have this conviction. Another way, first you prove that teaching to be infallible and without any logical fallacies, and then prove the Buddha to be authoritative. And so we can use that way of reasoning or leading disciples to have faith in the Dharma, Buddha, and his teaching. By proving the truth of the Dharma, then you actually lead the disciples to along the path and to attain cessation and the nirvana. So Lama Tsongkhapa says, even though he has actually taken refuge, he had taken refuge in the Buddha since his childhood for a long time. Since his childhood, he couldn't see the good qualities of the Buddha, not even a slight good quality of the Buddha. But once he actually understood that, Lama Tsongkhapa is saying that although he took refuge in the Buddha for a long time, he has not seen even the slightest good quality in the Buddha. It's just an exaggeration. Of course, he has seen the good quality of the Buddha. But what he was saying is that so what Lama Tsongkhapa was basically saying is that he found a very special way of conviction in the teaching of the Buddha, that the Buddha is infallible refuge. After he understood the teaching of dependent origination and leading to the understanding of emptiness, the subtlest understanding of emptiness. Then the qualities of the community or Sangha, the qualities of the teaching, and the qualities of Sangha. So regarding the qualities of the teaching, the companion of the teaching says, these Bhagavan Buddhas possess infinite and limitless good qualities. Such qualities are born from the teaching, from the proper practice of the teaching. The teaching creates and governs them. They arise from the teaching and are within the scope of the teaching. They depend upon the teaching. The teaching produces them. And the good qualities of the community, chief among the members of the community, are those persons who are noble beings. Think of them in light of their mindfulness of the good qualities of the teaching and their proper practice of it. The compendium of teachings says, think, the community teaches the teaching. practices it and reflects on it. It is a teaching sphere. It upholds the teaching and trusts itself to the teaching, worships the teaching, conducts itself God into the teaching. It has the teaching as its sphere of activity and is the most excellent practitioner of the teaching. It is naturally honest and pure. It is endowed with the quality of compassion and has great compassion. It always has solitude as its field of activity. Is always absorbed in the teaching and always practice virtue. Going for refuge by knowing the distinctions. According to the companion of determinations, you go for refuge after understanding the distinction among the three jewels. The distinction based on their defining characteristics, the distinction based on their enlightened activities, the distinction based on devotion, the distinction based on practice, the distinction based on recollection, the distinction based on how they increase merit, and then going for refuge through commitment. According to the Dhammamitra's commentary on the Sutra on discipline, going for refuge through commitment means upholding the Buddha as teacher of refuge, the teaching, Nirvana, as the actual refuge, and the community as those who assist us to attain refuge. And then next is going for refuge by refusing to acknowledge other refuges, where His Holiness emphasized on reading these verses from a praise of the Exalted One. The more I reflect on other non-Buddhist traditions, the greater becomes my faith, O Protector. Their minds, the minds are ruined by the faults of tenets. Their minds are ruined by the faults of tenets. Devised by those who are not omniscient. Those whose minds are ruined cannot even see faultless teacher. The distinction of the teaching, the Congress teaching allows you to attain its goals of bliss through joyful birth. It stops the stream of cyclic existence, clears away the afflictions, does not mislead those who desire liberation, is completely virtuous and clears away faults. Non-Buddhist teachings are the opposite. The praise of the Exalted One says, your teaching causes one to attain bliss through the joyful. Therefore, O line of speakers, intelligent beings, have faith in your tradition and praise. So through these citations you can also understand the scene of the community. And then now we are on page 193, chapter 12, under the section, the second set of subdivisions. So which is about actually about once you have gone for refuge, the stages of precepts, and then how they appear in compendium of determinations, the first set of subdivisions, relying on excellent person, listen to the sublime teachings, and fix your attention properly on them. Cultivate a practice that... So regarding the prescriptive precepts, those who go for refuge to the three... To the three jewels for refuge, come closer to the truly virtuous. They never go to other deities for refuge. So you can, of course, seek their help, but not go for refuge, worldly deities. Those who go to the sublime teaching for refuge harbor no harmful, murderous thoughts. Those who go to the community for refuge do not associate with non-Buddhist philosophers. Thus, there are three prescriptive precepts. Not going to other deities for refuge, abandoning harm and malice towards other living beings, and not befriending non-Buddhist philosophers. Not going for other deities for refuge is explained as follows. Since you should not even hold worldly deities as such as Rudra and Vishnu, as your ultimate refuge, what needs to be said about Nagas and the local divinities, local deities who are hungry ghosts? While it is improper to entrust yourself to these beings without full belief in the three refuges, it is proper to merely seek these beings' help for some temporary religious purpose, just as, for example, you would seek the help of a benefactor in acquiring the means of livelihood or consult a doctor for the cure of an illness. The second prescriptive precept entails in refraining from doing harm or injury to other living beings through thought or deed. This includes actions such as beating, binding, imprisoning, nose-piercing, and overburdening humans, animals, and so forth. The third precept entails not agreeing with those who do not believe in the rituals as a refuge and who repudiate them. The prescriptive precepts. There are three prescriptive precepts. The first is to treat images of the Buddha as objects of reverence, as though they were the teacher himself, not pointing out their faults regardless of their quality, and not disrespecting them or treating them with contempt by putting them in dishonorable places, pawning them, and etc. Page 195, the last paragraph. In the second paragraph, it's on this, there is this mention. It is said that the great yogi Changchub Rinchen once gave a statue of Manjugosha to the elder for him to examine. He asked, "How good is this? If it is good, I will buy it with 4 gold coins. Rongba Gargewa gave me." The elder replied, "Venerable Manjugosha's body has no defects. The sculptor is middling. The sculptor is middling and placed it on his head. It is said that he did the same with respect to all finished images." The second prescriptive precept is never to show disrespect for writing on the teachings. For writings of the teaching, even those composed of as little as 4 words. Further, you should not pawn volumes of scriptures, treat them as merchandise, and place them on the bare ground or in dishonorable places, carry them together with shoes, walk over them, etc. Treat them with respect, as though they were the teaching jewel itself. It is said that whenever Geshe Changawa saw a scripture being carried, he would stand up with his hands joined together in front of him in a gesture of respect. In later life, when he was unable to rise, he would simply join his hands. Also, it is said that the elder once encountered a mantra practitioner in Ngari who initially refused to listen to him teach. However, one day, the elder witnessed a scribe rubbing a page of the teaching with plague from his teach. Unable to bear this, he cried out, "Hey, don't do that, don't do that." As a result of which, the mantra practitioner gained faith in the elder and received the teaching from him. Furthermore, Sharava said, "We are playing around with the teachings in so many ways, showing disrespect for the teaching and its teachers ruins our wisdom. We are stupid enough now. Let's not create more stupidity. If we become even more stupid, what will we be able to do?" The third precept is never to revile or despise members of the community, renunciates, and those who merely possess the symbols of the practitioner of virtue, someone who is dressed as a monk or nun but has no vows. Nor should you do this to the mere symbols of the symbols. Parts of the robes of these practitioners. Never in any way divide yourself and others into opposing factions and view the others as enemies. Always treat members of the community with respect as though they were the community jewel itself. So even if when you actually look at the image of a Buddha, while you are agitated with anger. So in the Shaman Lamrim, it says that even in such circumstances, by looking at the Buddha's images, you will gain lots of merit. So although someone may not have any sense of taking refuge or anything like that in the Buddha, but because of the Buddha's having accumulated over thousands, over countless eons, having meditated and cultivated the altruistic intention to benefit others, to help others all the time, completed the accumulation of merit and wisdom, that has that kind of impact. So because of the, an individual's state of mind and how good and bad or altruistic or not the person is, of course there are different ways others see them. So someone who has cultivated bodhicitta for over countless eons and cultivated the store of merit and wisdom has such an impact on others who are agitated to have great merit just by seeing an image of that person. And the general precepts, by recalling the distinctions and good qualities of the three jewels, go for refuge again and again. And by recalling the greatness, great kindness of the three jewels, strive to worship them constantly and offer the first portion of your food and drink. So, and with regard to offerings, then there are the actions of offering, the attitude, and the attitude. The first of these include the following 10 types. Offering to the Buddha's body means offering to the actual Buddha as embodiment, as form. Offering to stupas means offering to stupas and the like for the sake of the Buddha. Offering to perceived object means offering to above mentioned two as they are manifest to your own sensory faculties. And offerings to non-perceived objects refers to offerings made to the Buddha or his stupa that are not actually present and made for the sake of all Buddhas and stupas. Offerings made for the sake of the Buddha or to Buddha, to one or many images and stupas after his nirvana, are also considered offerings to a non-perceived object. When you make offerings to either an unperceived Buddha or his perceived stupas, you are also making offerings to both of the perceived objects, for the reality or emptiness of one of them is reality of the other. It is standard to make offerings both to the perceived and non-perceived objects with the thought, I make offerings to all the Buddhas of the three times and to stupas of the 10 directions of the limitless universe. It is said that making offerings to a perceived object produces a vast store of merit, and making offerings to an unperceived object a greater store. Making offerings to all the Buddhas and stupas produces a store far more vast than that. Thus, it is important that when you make offerings to a single Buddha or his image and the like, you recollect the indivisibility of reality and project the thought that you are making offerings to all of them. Offerings made by yourself are offerings made manually by yourself. Do not have others make them for you out of your laziness, indifference, or callousness. Offerings that you help others to make refers to offerings that you, out of compassion, cause someone else to make. This occurs when you have some small things to offer and you think, oh, these suffering living beings who have a little merit and nothing to give will gain happiness by making these offerings. Furthermore, the merit of offerings made by both yourself and by others you have helped to make offerings are shared by both of you. The difference in the size of the meritorious results of these three being similar to the above discussion in the fourth section. Offerings of wealth and service, then vast offerings, offerings not contaminated with afflictions, and offerings of practice. To make these 10 types of offerings to the three jewels is to make a complete offering. The second aspect of offering, the attitude, is as follows. When you make then these 10 types of offerings, there are six attitudes that will render immeasurable the result of even a small offering to any of the three jewels. You should make offerings with the thoughts that there is no higher field of good qualities, there is no higher benefactor, he is the best of all living beings, he is extremely rare, like an Udhamvara flower. Since only one Buddha appears in the universe of 3 billion world systems, he is the only one, and he is the foundation of all mundane and supramundane good. I have written about these 10 types of offerings and six attitudes as they appear in the Bodhisattva levels. You should always make our best offerings to you can. Make especially good offerings on auspicious occasions and holidays, holy days, to the best of your ability. Furthermore, since you constantly have to eat and drink, always offer the first portion of your food and drink. If you do this without fail, you will easily amass a larger accumulation of merit. Thus, from the depths of your heart, always offer the first portion of whatever you consume, even water. So since our practice is such that we cannot even think of a supreme field of merit as we would an ordinary field, we should always strive to make offerings to the three jewels. By doing so, our mind's power with respect to the stages of the path will increase as a result of the strength of the roots of virtue grown in this excellent field of merit. Therefore, when your mind's power is so weak that we cannot retain the words, even when we study, understand the meaning when we reflect, or gain knowledge when we meditate, we should rely on the power of the field of merit. This is a personal instruction. In this vein, Sri Matrachetha also says, by depending on you, Bhagavan, my mind, though weak, has broadened like a river in the rainy season, attaining great skill in composing poetry. It is taught that offerings are not determined by the material objects offered, but by your faith. Thus, if you do not have material possessions to offer, then offerings of mandalas and water, or of things not held as property and the like, will suffice if you have faith. Some have possessions but are unable to give them up, quoting the verse, as I have no merit, I am very poor, I have no other wealth for offerings. This is, as Bodhava said, like a blind person trying to fool a sighted person by dropping a bit of sod incense into a smelly conch cup and saying, this is water scented with sandalwood and camphor. Pujungwa said, first I give sod incense with a sharp odor. Next, I obtain sweet-smelling long stick of incense made from four substances to give. Now I give aromatic akaru, durukska, and the like. Thus, if you despise small offerings and do not give them, your entire life will pass in that way. However, if you make earnest effort in stages, and beginning with small things, conditions will improve. You should practice as Pujangwa did. It is said that on one occasion he made a preparation of incense worthy 22 gold coins. Worth 22 gold coins. Great beings who have gained control over material things emanate many hundreds of thousands of bodies, each of which in turn emanate hundreds of thousands of hands. Visiting all the Buddha realms, they make offerings to the conquerors for many eons. They can do all this while others settle for small achievements that look good and say, I do not expect enlightenment through making offerings. This is the nonsense. Nonsense of those who have little exposure to the teaching. Thus, we should do as it is said in the Clouds of Jewel Sutra. And next, establishing the study any of the vows, offerings, and acts of service in the sutras such as these. With supreme wholehearted resolve, sincerely dedicate these offerings and acts of service before the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And next is establishing other living beings in this practice by considering them with compassion. So we make the distinction between Buddhist and non-Buddhist traditions on the basis of whether someone has taken refuge in the rituals or not. This may be how to differentiate on an ordinary level, but when we, with regard to taking refuge, in a special way of taking refuge, then we have to understand the four seals of the Dharma. On the basis of that, when we take refuge, it becomes a very special way of taking refuge in the three jewels. So by taking refuge, your thought or determination for liberation or nirvana will be strengthened, maybe stabilized. The intended meaning of these passages is that you make your aspiration for nirvana firm by going for refuge, and that your vows arise from this. Next, you reduce the elimination and eliminate previously accumulated karmic obstructions. In the section where it teaches that going for refuge clears away sins, the compendium of trainings says, here you should take the edifying tale of the pig as an animal, as an example. Thus, just as the god who was about to be reborn as a pig avoided such a birth by going for refuge, so too you eliminate the condition for rebirth in a miserable realm by going for refuge. Consequently, it is said, those who go for refuge to the Buddha do not go to miserable realms. After giving up human form, they assume the bodies of deities. The same teaching applies to taking refuge in the teaching and the community. Some previously accumulated sins are reduced and some are eliminated. You will accumulate vast merit. This is explained previously. You will not fall into the miserable realms. You should understand this form from the earlier explanations. You will not be thwarted by humans and non-human hindrances. Here you should use as examples the stories about the non-Buddhists who mastered the magic rope and so forth. You will accomplish everything you wish. You will quickly achieve Buddhahood. Maintain your refuge and do not forsake the three jewels, even in jest or if it costs your life.
Inevitably, you'll lose your body, life, and resources. But if you forsake the three jewels for the sake of these, you will suffer continually throughout many lives. And where Lama Tsongkhapa says, I have not seen the source, his Holiness thinks perhaps it is this sutra called Dispelling the Darkness of the Ten Directions. I have presented the six general precepts in accordance with how they appear in Atisha's commentary on difficult points of the Lamb for the Path to Enlightenment. The first three of the special precepts are explained in the sutras, the other three in Vimalamitra's six aspects of going for refuge. An image, a verse, or discarded scrap of yellow cloth, out of faith and belief. Consider it to be the teacher. Do not mistakenly deny anything he has said. Rather, place it on the crown of your head. View pure and impure persons as though they were noble. So it says... After that, with respect to the precepts drawn from the compendium of determination, the sayings of Gamapa state, Nirusubha did not teach these precepts for going for refuge, but he has, as I received them together from Gambawa. So there was no, Nirusubha's Lamrim didn't contain this precept of taking refuge. They appear in the presentation of the stages of the path transmitted from Gumbawa through Lumbawa. How contravening these precepts causes weakening and forsaking of the precepts causes weakening and forsaking of your refuge is explained as follows. Some assert that if you violate six of the precepts, the first three special precepts, plus the precepts of constantly going for refuge, not forsaking refuge, even for the sake of your life and making offering to the three jewels, you have given up your refuge. Others include the last three special precepts and assert that contravention of nine precepts constitute forsaking refuge. Contravention of the remaining precepts weaken your refuge. However, an actual forsaking of refuge means that you have contravened the precept not to forsake refuge, even for the sake of your life. Similarly, even if... So the concluding paragraph, thus the Buddha is one who teaches refuge. The community insists you in the assist you in accomplishing refuge. So with the teachings pertaining to the beings with intermediate scope are actual way of taking refuge in the real sense by understanding the dharma, to cessation and so forth. So with regard to this, but the real refuge is the jewel of the teaching, because once you have attained it, you are liberated from fear. With regard to this, the ultimate teaching is... So the actual refuge is the Dhamma jewel. It says, once you have attained it, you are liberated from fear. So at this point, we can talk about being free from or liberated from the suffering of suffering for in context of the beings of small scope. And so with regard to this ultimate teaching, jewel is defined as being the special fulfillment of the gradual increase of the two things. So it's not yet 11:30. It's close to it, to 11:30. So, explanation of how to rely on the methods for the happiness of future worlds. So taking refuge in the three jewels. Although, in general, there are many causes for taking refuge, here it is the fact that
As explained above, we do not stay in this life but soon die, and after that we do not have control over where we will be reborn and are under the control of our karma. Karma is also set forth in engaging in with the sattva conduct. As a flash of lightning amid the clouds illuminates the darkness for a moment, likewise on the road through the power of the Buddhas, a rare understanding of the merit comes forth in the worldly. Therefore, that which is virtuous is always weak, while evil is extremely strong and unbearable. By thinking thus about how you will fall into the lower realms, because the power of wholesome karma is small and the power of unwholesome karma is extremely strong, the two arises. Fear of the lower realms and the conviction that that which is rare and precious, the three jewels, can protect you from them. Consequently, if these two remain, but words taking refuge will be similar. However, if they are present intense and firm, taking refuge, your taking refuge will also come to tame the mind. Therefore, you should strive in those two causes. Depending on two causes, the objects in which to take refuge, identifying the objects of refuge, thus, if someone has intelligence to differentiate between what is refuge and what is not a refuge, it is appropriate for him to take refuge in the undeceiving protector, the Buddha Bhagavan. That this also characterizes the Dhamma jewel and the Sangha jewel. From 70 verses on taking refuge, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha are the refuge for those who want liberation. Someone who is free from all fears, skilled in the means of liberating others from fears, steeped in great compassion towards everyone without closeness and distance, and who works for the welfare of all those who help him or do not help him, such a one is worthy to be a refuge. And only the Buddha has those qualifications, while Ishvara and the like do not. He is a refuge. For that reason, the Dharma taught by him, as well as the Sangha of the hearers, and also are also worthy to be refuges. That being so, once you have derived certainty with regard to the objects of refuge set forth in the compendium, when you are able to rely on them with a single-pointed mind, it is impossible for you not to be protected. Therefore, you should generate certainty from the bottom of your heart of the two causes of for being protected. There is no incompleteness in the external one, since our teacher has already accomplished it. However, due to the internal cause, taking hold of that refuge trustingly, not having come about, we suffer. The positive qualities of Buddha's exalted body and the positive qualities of Buddha's exalted speech, the positive qualities of the exalted mind, positive qualities of knowledge, positive qualities of mercy. Caring or compassion, did you think? Just as sentient beings are bound by afflictions without any control, the sage is bound by great compassion without control. And therefore, great compassion continuously arises in him when he perceives suffering migrating beings. In 150 verses, it says, all of these migrating beings are equally bound by afflictions. In order to unite these afflictions, untie their afflictions, you have long been bound by compassion. Should I first persuade to you, or that which causes you to stay long in samsara, aware of its faults, great compassion. Then the quotation from the chapter of the Truthful One. Remember his mercy in accordance with these statements. The positive qualities of the Buddha's exalted activities, by means of both spontaneous, uninterrupted, exalted activities of exalted body,
the
Therefore, think about the Buddha's positive qualities again and again and try to achieve as much certainty in them as possible. If it develops, you will have reached the main point of taking refuge, because similar certainty will come concerning the Dharma that you have received from him and the Sangha and those of those who have accomplished that Dharma. Without it, there is no way to taking refuge or taming the mind, let alone other paths will occur either. The positive qualities of the Dharma, on account of your respect for the Buddha, you should be mindful thinking, in fact, that the Buddha has. In fact, that the Buddha has limitless positive qualities arose from his manifesting and meditating on the Dharma of scriptures and realization, true cessation and true paths, the epitome of the abandonment of faults and the achievement of positive qualities. That is the intention of the compendium of the teachings. This refers mainly to persons who are Aryas, recalling the positive qualities of Sangha, recalling the positive qualities of the Dharma. You will be mindful of those who accomplish it correctly. That is the intention of the compendium of the teaching. And then taking refuge in understanding their distinctions, as is apparent from compendium of determination, you should take refuge aware of the distinctions between the three jewels. As is apparent from the commentary on the sutra, the discipline, you should take refuge in terms of considering the Buddha to be the one who teaches the refuge, the Dharma to be Nirvana, which is the actual refuge, and the Sangha to be the companions who accomplished refuge, taking refuge without advocating other ones. Then the stages of training after having taken refuge. The specific precepts for the individual objects of refuge, and precepts of prohibition, and then precepts of accomplishment. So prescriptive and prescriptive precepts, in other words. So regarding the prescriptive precepts, in accordance with the statement above, there are the three precepts: not to take refuge in other gods, not to abandon causing harm or difficulty to sentient beings, and not to associate with foreigners. So you should abandon causing harm or difficulty to humans, animals, and so forth through thought and actions like beating them, binding them, and ensnaring them, piercing their nose, and loading them unbearably. You should not conform to those who are unconvinced by the protection of the three jewels and who denigrate them. Then the prescriptive accomplishments or prescriptive precepts. The actual way to train with respect to representations of a Buddha, examples of the fully ripened effects of past irreverence. Then next is precepts associated with the Dharma, which has two parts, the actual precepts and how the masters of former times acted. So it is said that when Adisha was in Ngari, one Pandit practitioner did not listen to Dharma teachings from him. However, when a scribe smeared residue from his teeth on a Dharma text
And Odisha saw it and unable to bear it, said, "Alas, that's not good. That's not good." The Tantrika gained faith and listened to his teachings. Sharava said, "We play around with the Dharma in all sorts of ways. Irreverence for the Dharma and the expounder of the Dharma is a cause for distorted wisdom. We are already confused enough now. What will we do if we become more, even more confused?" And then, "You should not abuse or despise the Sangha, even those who merely bear the signs of ordination. Nor should you look at them as opponents in any way. Having made arbitrary divisions in terms of your group and my group, instead you should treat them with respect, and if they were Sangha, as if they were Sangha jewels." La. Etam Guru Ratna Mendalakam Niyatayami. Allez.